Anna Journey is a poet, essayist, and teacher who has created a body of work which is at the center of much of what is most stimulating about contemporary poetry. And her work is widely discussed and very much enjoyed by young poets around the country who often want to interview her, seeking to discover exactly how she does it all. Anna is also a graduate of the VCU MFA program, and all of us here have a distinct measure of pride in her many accomplishments, including her having gone on to earn a doctorate at the University of Houston and her achievement of now being a member of the Distinguished Creative Writing Faculty at the University of Southern California. Anna is the author of the poetry collections Vulgar Remedies, which came out from LSU Press in 2013, and her third book is coming out from LSU Press as well 1 year from now. It's called The Atheist Wore Goat Silk. And she started out of the gate with her first book, If Birds Gather Your Hair for Nesting, which was published by the University of Georgia Press in 2009, after having been selected by Thomas Lux as the winner of the open competition of the National Poetry Series. Her poems have been published in American Poetry Review, the Best American Poetry Field, the Kenyon Review, the Southern Review, and many other journals. And she also has published widely her creative nonfiction and essays in literary criticism. The quality of her writing has also earned her fellowships from the Academy of American Poets, the Corporation of Yaddo, the National Endowment for the Arts, and elsewhere. I am proud and happy to call her my friend, Anna Journey.
Thank you, Greg, for that introduction. So great being back at VCU around so many old friends. I'll read a couple poems from my first book, which I wrote when I was in the program here at VCU. About 10 years ago, I worked in the lawn and garden section of the Lowe's hardware shop on West Broad. And so this poem takes that place as its setting. And it also weaves in some of my mother's fascination with serial killers, if you can imagine those two realms intersecting. Lucifer's Panties at Lowe's Garden Center. I told the serial killer he could feed his Venus flytrap spam. The summer I worked the outdoor lawn and garden center. I'd known to say this since 15, with my mother telling me, all men who ask young girls directions from their white vans are murderers, especially ones wearing an arm in a sling who ask you to carry things. This one asked about hibiscus. I said, rum runner, the fifth dimension, eye of the storm. The flower with my own name, Anna Elizabeth, was too damn pink and ruffled. I switched its label, wrote Lucifer's Panties, stuck its white plastic flag back. I named others unquenchable burning, hell flames, fire on the back of your dark tongue. He wanted instead to apologize with the crepe yellow hybrid for a woman whose dining room window he'd shattered with a corner of drywall. He asked if the gift was a good idea. I told him he was going to need a good pot, one with an angel, copper frog, fat gnome, or fairy. Girls love that shit. Probably terracotta. His slung arm, likely struck by lightning from handling Bluebeard's hoard on the aluminum bed of his construction van. I helped him repot. The killer grasping the flower's pale trumpets, me tamping the dark roots. Before he left, a turnip moth played the wind chimes above the register without touching them. I pointed to the label, direct sun, but couldn't say, bring the blooms indoors before the frost. I was talking with my friend the other day. You know, we were talking about how there are anthologies out there on almost every conceivable subject, but we had agreed that there should be one on the subject of finding your favorite relative's porn stash. The mirror's lake is forever. That's when I knew the mirror was all sex and hard fact, unlike knowing my grandfather posthumously. Because a ghost can't be androgynous as a lamp is, as peat moss is, as the smell of cedar, knife feathery. Because the dead can watch me pee without even a trace of embarrassment. And who has the right to more? Mirror that couldn't reach my dead grandfather's closet. His jewel-colored medical books in former editions. His gay porn magazines. Men smooth as conchs in softcore seascapes. My mother, who found them while cleaning out his house, asks, "Are you sorry I told you?" I said, "No, I'm not sorry." As if staring into his horn rims and my grandmother's coral dress could help me understand the selfishness of portraits, their shut door splintering the past's exact coffin space. I know that shame is beard high with two daughters, the blonde one with cats, and the dark one with red-haired girls. I know the mirror's lake is forever dragged for corpses, lily buoyant arteries, livers, and cocks. I know he's caught there, doctor, with his white coat and gold-veined tobacco. And what is more haunted than the smoked voices of cicadas under plums? And what heats faster than silver? His constellation, cold instruments raised over useless space. Somewhere there's a ghost I'll open my shirt for, recount my entire medical history for, who I'll forgive for wearing tweed and love beads and for hiding stacks of magazines in the dark, who will press that silver scope to his ear, who will listen. Read a couple from my book, Vulgar Remedies. A few years back, I lived in Houston, Texas for a while, and I don't know if any of you have spent much time in Texas, but if your AC breaks, even for like a few days, it is cause for grievous alarm. Warning. As heat moves through like its own animal, whose evening pulse is headlights and the reply of lit cat's eyes, as the amber of Freon streaked my ceiling and the ceiling begins to cave, I've had no AC for days. I've had knuckles unfold from the oleanders, try to lock with mine. They're boiled and hazy in their summer whites. Why, I remember the boy from down the street who often begged to suck my eyeball. My pupil rolled under his tongue, the one whose scent was clove smoke and a soft brie winging after a blinding light. I must have singed the buds in his tongue to desert thistles, left us taste like a saint's charred footprint. As you recede, memory, a warning, my eye might make something calcify, a stone through your sleep, shorn dog so nude it's another nocturnal shiver. As sweat stings my eye, you'll recall the taste, and the blue cacti, stoppered with blooms, will seize like blown crepe. As you know, the actress Natalie Wood drowned right off the coast of Los Angeles, off the coast of Santa Catalina Island. And what you may not know is I got married there a few years ago. This is as close as I'm going to get, I think, to an epithalamium. Wedding night. We share an heirloom tomato on our hotel balcony, overlooking the ocean in which Natalie Wood drowned. We imagine Natalie held a gelatinous green sliver on her tongue, that its watery disc caught the lamplight before she slipped from her yacht to drown in the waves off this island. This was 30 years ago, and our tomato strain stretches back decades to an heirloom seed saved before either of us was born, before Natalie's elbow brushed the clouded jade face of the ancestral fruit in a Catalina stand, before she handed it to her husband, saying, "This one." We hover near the plate where the last half of our shadow tomato sits in its skin's deep pleats. I lean toward you to trace each salted crease with a thumbnail, brined and wild as those lines clawed in the green side of the yacht's rubber dinghy. Those lingering shapes the coroner found, the drowned actress's scratch marks. That night we first met, I had another lover, but you didn't care. My Bellini's peach puree, our waiter said, had sailed across the Atlantic from France. It swirled as I sipped and sank to the glass bottom of my champagne flute. You whispered, "Guilt is the most useless emotion." After Natalie rolled into the waves, the wet feathers of her down coat wrapped their white anchors at her hips. This was 1981. I turned a year old that month, and somewhere an heirloom seed washed up. You felt an odd breeze knock at your elbow as I took my first step. We hadn't yet met. Tonight, we watched the wet date palms tip toward the surf and, curling, swallow their tongues. So a term that you may not be familiar with is the term fistulated cow, and it refers to a cow with a fistula in its side, and a fistula is a hole made in the side of an animal for the purposes of scientific research. So, you know, farmers or researchers can peer into one of a cow's stomachs and observe the processes of digestion and things like that, and you can even kind of unscrew the lid to a fistula and reach your hand in if you are so inclined. When I reached into the stomach of a fistulated dairy cow, sixth grade field trip to Sunny's dairy barn. Clover and oats, a tangle of bile-singed Timothy hay. What Sunny said we'd feel. Gloves kissed to our elbows. Ferment of the winter cow field. I feel a whole bitten pasture as it broke down inside her. Blue barn, sweet with the atomic shudder of barley. I reach past that weave of hot forage to the fuchsia grove, where after future lover and I drop acid, he'll wrap my neck and wind my nipples with the fringy mimosas, burlesque feathers. I reach back and further through fields to the French Canadian with a musket wound blown through his left side. The stomach wound that gaped like hibiscus wouldn't heal, even as he married a white-haired girl from Lake Michigan's coast, fathered two girls. I touch her cheek, where a platinum strand splits her eye from her lip, which opens and shuts and opens. I watch her feed him plum halves on a string so she can pull the desiccated fruit from his side's portal to know how matter moves through his body. Now the cow's gut contracts and holds my forearm. I'd scream except for the throb of her back's heat, the peat moss below that pillows our joined shadow. Cow and a girl grafted as a radical experiment. No, it's when I grew a whole heaving beast for a palm, my wrist which holds a Holstein's pulse. Pull like a wound where inside the hay breaks its weave, where the shredded mimosa won't shut. I'll just close with three newer poems from my forthcoming collection. A while back, I'd read about a scientist who developed these genetically modified goats that have been spliced with silkworm DNA. And so he calls them these spider goats. So I wrote a poem about one, and he actually tracked me down after he found the poem online. I guess he has like a Google alerts out on spider goats or something. And he invited me to visit his mutant goats in Salt Lake City if I happen to be coming through town. The atheist wore goat silk. I've wanted to visit the genetically modified goat spliced with silkworm DNA, spinning white threads from its pink udders like a piebald spider. I've wondered how much for a whole goat silk dress. I always save the spiders that shimmy near my eyes, but never the bristled silverfish, which drop to the boatwood dinner table from the skylight. Come Indian summer, the fuchsia bougainvillea unpurses its dry lips, licks the sweat from my neck. My mother tells her childhood best friend, who's dying from liver cancer in Jackson, who consults a Pentecostal woman who speaks in tongues, that her two daughters are atheists, meaning my little sister and me. Somewhere there's a goat that squirts a rare silk so bizarre, maybe no one would actually wear it. That webbed dress sticking to my chest, the grandfather clock, all over the bedroom walls like a past that drags everything with it. The thread leading back to an animal I badly need to believe in. It's impossible milk steams in the twilight. There's a dress that rises from its udders with a misted sleeve I can almost see. Back when I lived here in Richmond, I knew this guy, a young guy, like in his early 20s, but he had the most spectacular, gravelly blues voice, like the voice of an ancient blues singer. But the curious thing that he wasn't born with that voice. Accidental blues voice. My ex-lover received it at 17. skiing the steep slope at Wintergreen called Devil's Elbow. The early snowmelt along the blue ridge had slipped the white limb of a birch through the crust, jutted that camouflage tip into the center of the trail. He hit it full speed, flipped over ski poles. One of them split his vocal cords with its aluminum point. He sprawled in the snow, his pink throat skewered like Saint Sebastian, or the raw quiver of his Greek father's peppered lamb kebabs. The doctors didn't let him speak for a year, and when he finally tried, his choir boy voice had gravel in it. His tenor had a bloody birch limb in it, had a knife in it, had a whole lower octave clotted in it, had a wounds and a wounds cracked whisper in it. The first time I heard him sing in his blues band, 5 years after the accident, I told him his smoked rasp sounded exactly like Tom Waits, like my grandfather 60 years since the iron lung. I couldn't believe a growl like that crawled up from the lips of a former Catholic schoolboy. But as he shut off the halogen overhead, leaving only the ultraviolet of his bedside's blacklight, he stroked my cheek, crooned, "Good night, Irene." His teeth and his throat's 3-inch scar glowed a green neon. This is the last poem I'll read. Thank you so much for coming out tonight, you guys. It's been really fun being here. When I fly on airplanes, I like to read like trashy fashion magazines. I think, you know, like Cosmo and stuff like that. And there's this reader's confession section of Cosmo where readers write in and confess their embarrassing secrets. And there was this one woman who confessed that she had gotten a tattoo of a barcode on her arm. And like as a joke, she asked a cashier at a grocery store to scan it and see what came up. And allegedly she rang up as like a $5 box of condoms. But I thought that was too much of a punchline, right? And so I had to make it something else. Upon asking the cashier at Kroger to scan that old tattoo of a barcode on my forearm, turns out my body's a dollar sweet potato, her register's screen said, as she lifted her scanner and I laughed. I can finally call myself Garnet, Georgia Jet, Carolina Red. Those names of tubers, my accidental totems, so many varieties. I might slather my arm in marshmallows, burrow deep into the southern earth. I'd gotten the tattoo at 19, drunk, after Alicia and I sneaked into the Jefferson, the fanciest hotel in Richmond, with its old deco fountain in the lobby, where pet alligators swam circles through the jazz age. We sat on velveteen love seats, wearing ripped jeans among the suits of Virginia politicians and Baptist preachers, daring each other, I'll get a tattoo if you do. We discussed passion, vines on biceps, or matching dragonflies winging our asses. I swirled my plastic flask's bourbon, decided we'd make a statement about consumerism, blue barcode stamped on each of our forearms. After the hotel manager kicked us out for vagrancy, I tore a page from a book of grocery store coupons, so the tattoo artist would have an image to copy, a barcode's exact marks. I didn't think to stop and choose which vegetable, which object. Didn't know my body would soften beneath the lines. 10 years later, I'd finally ask a woman to scan the ink, wondering why I'd waited this long to find out. I've always been sweet, but slightly twisted. I've always been waiting to disappear like this, bite by bite, into someone's mouth. Thank you, guys.
David St. John is a singular, strong strand in a web of poets who have mattered a great deal to me, as well as to everyone who cares about poetry. His great mentor, the late Philip Levine, helped make a life in poetry possible for an entire generation of poets for whom he became a hero. And David shared that teacher with our former colleague and my great friend, Larry Levis. And those poets have in their turn mentored and assisted several more generations of American poets whose work matters. David has recently edited The Darkening Trapeze, Last Poems, a posthumous volume of work of Larry Levis, which is garnering enormous attention from readers of poetry around the country. David has also been here at VCU this week as our distinguished visiting writer, giving a master workshop to poets in our graduate creative writing program. And we are grateful for his bringing his tremendous skill and generosity as a teacher to us and to our students. David's own poetry is consistently adventurous and inventive, even as it makes powerful emotional and psychological connections and revelations available to his readers, and is simply one of our essential figures in poetry in America. His outstanding work has been recognized by numerous distinguished fellowships and prizes over the course of his career, including the Rome Prize Fellowship and the Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the O.B. Hardison Prize from the Folger Shakespeare Library, and the George Drury Smith Lifetime Achievement Award. In 2009, with Cole Swenson, he edited a much-discussed and somewhat controversial work, widely used as a textbook now, American Hybrid, a Norton Anthology of New Poetry. He has himself authored at least 10 poetry collections, most recently The Window from Arctos Press in 2014 and The Auroras from HarperCollins in 2012. His earlier books are a roster of widely influential works, including Study for the World's Body, nominated for the National Book Award in Poetry, No Heaven, The Shore, and Hush. I've been giving poems from these books to my students for them to study for many years. And when you encounter his work this evening, you may see why. David St. John.
Thank you, Greg. This is The Darkening Trapeze, Larry's book, the second posthumous book of poems of Larry Levis's. And there are a lot of people in this room who helped make this book possible. Mary Flynn, Greg Donovan, everyone at the Special Collections, the library, including Gregory Kimbrell in the back, who was my valiant touchstone whenever I had a textural question, something that I needed to really find out about through different drafts and the endless drafts, it was always Gregory who came through for me. I want to read the very first poem in the book, and it's also the oldest poem in the book. It actually dates from a manuscript of Larry's poems that was called Winter Stars. And it's a poem that was taken out of that manuscript for what I discovered were very personal reasons. And it's called Gossip in the Village. I told no one, but the snows came anyway. They weren't even serious about it at first. Then they seemed to say, if nothing happened, snow could say that, and almost perfectly. The village slept in the gunmetal oil of its evening. And there, through a thin dress once, I touched a body so alive and eager. I thought it must be someone else's soul. And though I was mistaken, and though we parted, and the roads kept thawing between snows. In the first spring sun, and it was all like spring, irrevocable. Irony has made me thinner. Someday, weeks from now, I will wake alone. My fate, will think, will be to have no fate. I will feel suddenly hungry. The morning will be bright and wrong. One of the first times, I think actually the first time I came to Richmond, and I've been here many times since, was to visit Larry after he'd moved here. And there are a lot of people in this room who knew Larry and love Larry. And so if you get a chance, make sure you look at the cover, because one of the panels of this Francis Bacon painting on the cover, this dude looks a lot like Larry. I just want you to know. He would be so happy to see that. I want to read a poem from this new little book called The Window. And the poems actually come from different periods in my writing life. The poem I'm about to read is actually a poem that first belonged to the book called The Auroras. And for a lot of different reasons, I ended up having to take it out. And yet it was a poem that I really always loved. And John Michael reminded me how much I loved it. So it's called Epiphanies. Along the delicate scrollwork of her shoulders, seven sentences of fear. Beneath the cardinal tides of the morning, the white crocuses had fallen, just as beneath the majestic fronds of the palms lay the litany of Orphic psalms. All of it felt like a window onto my own grave. All of it rippled like the soft gaze of Athena I could not hold in my precious self-regard. It was then the caramel-colored skeletons arose, vigilant sentinels of the long-deliberated past. Those little Dada lessons of the forgetful heart. So I'm just going to go from one cheery poem to the other. So just tell me. We've all, at some point in our lives, for some of you, maybe a grandparent, for many of us, our parents, who begin to disappear before they, whether it's dementia, whether it's Alzheimer's, they begin to fade in this way. And this is a poem that was written for my mother about 2 years before she died. It's called From a Bridge. I saw my mother standing there below me on the narrow bank, just looking out over the river, looking at something just beyond the taut middle rope of the braided swirling currents. Then she looked up quite suddenly to the far bank, where the densely twined limbs of the cypress twisted violently toward the storm-struck sky. There are some things we know before we know. Also, some things we wish we would not ever know, even if as children we already knew. And so, standing above her on that bridge that shuddered each time the river ripped at its wooden pilings, I knew I could never, even fate willing, ever get to her in time. And this is called Without Mercy, the Rains Continued. There had been a microphone hidden beneath the bed. Of course, I didn't realize it at the time, and in fact, didn't know for years, until one day a standard khaki book mailer arrived, and within it, an old stained cassette tape, simply labeled in black marker, Him, Me, September 1975. And as I listened, I knew something had been asked of me across the years and loneliness, to which I simply responded with the same barely audible silence that I had chosen then. And I want to read one more poem from, you thought I was going to say it's the last poem, but you're not so lucky. One more poem from the Auroras, then I'm going to read some new poems. And this is called Hungry Ghost. When I came to see you, it hurt me how thin you had become in the months of addiction and disease. And although your particular abyss was a man and not a drug, the degradation was the same. The same wasting of flesh, the same tapped out well emptied of the least leaf of emotion, the same frozen rage. When I came to your hotel room, you were sitting in a hard chair just by the window, half slumped and distracted, looking out at the persistent rain, then silently back at me. Your ghost, your own ghost, had already come. She sat by you at the small table, and she was so hungry. At one point, she reached over, reached right inside you, and slowly twisted off a moist wafer of your heart. She put it in her mouth and let it sit a moment on her tongue, her lips parting in a way both petulant and suggestive. It was clear she would eat all of you. I walked into the bathroom, and at the dulled zinc sink, I rinsed one by one the fat spring strawberries I'd brought you from the ranch. I put them in the white ceramic bowl I'd carried from our kitchen, and without a word, simply placed it on the table just beside your ghost. She stared at me, and then only at the fleshy rubies awaiting her, and ate until only a few rivulets of blood traced the bottom of the bowl and the green crowns she'd torn from their bodies lay scattered where they'd fallen at her feet. At last she seemed sated, even placated. She barely looked over as I wrapped you in your overcoat. You glanced at her, and she at you. The rain still steady at the pane. And then I realized you could not stand alone. And so I lifted you up to take you home. So I want to read some poems from a section of new poems. The next book of mine that will come out is actually a book of selected and new poems called The Last Troubadour. And it'll, you know, don't look for it anytime soon. It's like, you know, it's, these things take time. But it's coming out from Echo Press. Some of you know I used to live in Ohio, and I taught at Oberlin College, and part of that time I lived in Cleveland. And I realized that I always wanted to set up home in Ohio. I mean, James Wright can do it. And this poem is called Hot Night in Akron. My downstairs neighbors were out for the night seeing the clash in Cleveland, which meant it was okay for Jolene to practice her flamenco routine on my linoleum kitchen floor in just Cuban heels and t-shirt, having uncurled from the bed just a moment before, and I still couldn't move even one muscle as the riveting gunshot rhythms began to ricochet through my little apartment. But I rose up on one elbow to answer the clanging of the phone on the floor right by the mattress, and it was my once friend Elijah, still way PTSD after 5 years in country and out. And before I could try closing the bedroom door, he asked, "Are those shots?" as he heard the flamenco's crescendo. And I said, "Yeah, but nothing serious, just some assholes popping off at the frog pond." Then he started up telling me he didn't know where his wife was, but when he did find out, he'd kill the motherfucker she was sleeping with. And it went on like that, a while before I said, "Good luck," and I had to go. And just then, Jolene stopped dead in her steps and peeled off her t-shirt, the sweat pouring off her as I walked over to wrap both arms around her and hold on a moment before I told her, "I guess you better go home now." That was Elijah calling. And she asked me, "What did he want?" And I said, "Just you." And this is a poem, the subject of whom you'll recognize. It's called "The One Who Should Write My Elegy Is Dead." The one who should write my elegy is dead. When we made that bet, he said most likely I'd be the loser, writing his elegy instead. "Nothing is as beautiful as nothing," he once said. "So hip, just chain-smoking camels, or riding his shaky triumph up Van Ness, and the one who should write my elegy is dead." I guess I always knew I'd have to write my own elegy for him instead. Rambo on a tractor, Anna says, or Jagger pirouetting through the ranch's drying shed. The one who should write my elegy is dead. So I won't rehearse again those hungers that we fed, or expose both the cruelties and those we shared. I'll simply try again to finish writing this last elegy instead of looking back. And tonight, my daughter Vivian's off with friends, and Anna's reading, of all things, Winter Stars in bed. And the one who should write my elegy is dead. And I'm the one, the loser, left here, just as he said I'd be left here, writing his elegy instead. So I want to read one last poem. So thank you all for being here. A lot of you know that, you know, Anna and I are happy to sign books, but what you don't know is that I'm always happy to sign books with any name you choose. So, like, it's getting harder to find a signed Eliot, so. And this is a poem called To a Story. We'd become friends after I rented the empty studio behind her redwood house in Tiburon. As soon as she asked if I was good with my hands, I understood she had a few things that might need fixing around the place, including her Jag convertible, an old 57 XK 120. Aged to a dull bullet silver by the salty bay air. The walnut dash framing those twin discs of its black gauges, speedometer and tack. And you know, there's nothing I love like an elegant restoration in loving progress. Stop giving me that look. Her ex-husband, Edison, had even left a few berets in the closet hung above his oil paints. And I loved that old studio, its raw, uneven redwood planks letting in the soft fog at night, as well as those delicate early Brahms sonatas she'd practice as her ritual before leaving on tour. And then, always away a month or more, so I'd watch the place and bring in the mail and guard her koi pond from skinny dog-sized raccoons cruising up the narrow lanes at night. One morning, she called out of the blue on her layover in Reykjavik and just started screaming how Esquire had a story in it about her. Not one of those devoted profiles she knew well, but a piece of actual fiction, a story about her by Edison. And she hated him truly, after letting him get away with the endless affairs and years of good drugs and bad rehab she'd paid for. And finally, he'd gone too far. He'd made her into nothing but a story. And worse, claimed she'd been older than she was when they first met. And now she was screaming so loudly, I'm pretty sure most of Iceland could hear her say, "That fucking bastard even made me throw out the black panties Keith Richards signed for me." And I said, "Ilaria, just focus. Everybody knows Edison's a liar." And then a long silence, exquisitely cold as Reykjavik, before I heard, "I am going now to catch my plane." More silence, and then, "Don't leave me." Thank you.